A Mitch and Jeremy exclusive.
Are you ready?
On air.
Are you ready?
Online.
Are you ready to have a good time?
On your smart speaker and wherever you stream.
The Mitch LaFon and Jeremy White Show.
The Mitch LaFon and Jeremy White Show.
Available wherever you stream.
Catch up on past interviews and episodes on demand now.
Subscribe so you don't miss any of it.
Look, let's get right into this. Four-time Grammy-nominated legendary reggae pop band are going to be performing their big hits on the Bigga Bigga Redeem Tour, kicking off on August 18th at the River Breeze Event Center, Knoxville, Tennessee, rolling through Detroit, Pittsburgh, Newark, New York, Boston, St. Petersburg, Florida, the Janus Live, all the way through to Fort Worth, Texas, wrapping up in early September at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles, California. Pick up their latest record that came out last year as well. Welcome to the show. For the
go
first
ahead and
time,
say what the title is, by the way. Go ahead.
One more time. Bigga Bagga Redeem. There it is. Welcome to the show for the first time, Matthew Doyle and Robin Campbell from UB40. What's up, gentlemen?
Hi, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Great to see you.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Mitch, I want to hear you say the album title first before
it's
we
really
get
easy. It's really, really simple. Bigga Bagga Redeem.
Bigga Bagga Redeem.
See?
There you go.
See?
I did an album in the mid-80s called Bagga Redeem.
Right.
Which was a collaboration album, but using mostly local artists from Birmingham. We also did the Chrissie Hynde tune as well on the album, but the rest of the album was with local people, whereas this one is a more international thing. We've used artists from all over the world that we've worked with over the years. And because it's a more international collection, we decided to call it a Bigga Bagga Redeem.
Right.
Yeah. And by the way, that their first album came out when I graduated high school, believe it or not. Well, since we're on that album, just Chrissie Hynde, you did that I Got You, Babe with her, the big Sonny and Cher song. Just quickly talk to me about that collaboration, because you're sort of known for doing great covers from Red Red Wine to Can't Stop Falling in Love to I Got You, Babe.
Yeah, I think reggae lends itself to covers, you know. We've been listening to covers done by reggae artists all of our lives. Even stuff that we thought was originals, like Red Red Wine, we had no idea it was a Neil Diamond tune. We knew it as a record by a guy called Tony Tribe, who was a Jamaican reggae artist, you know, and that was the version that we knew as teenagers. And we never heard the Neil Diamond version until many years later when people told us that it was a Neil Diamond tune.
Right.
But, you know, we had no idea. And that's pretty much how it's been every time we've done covers like that. You know, it's we're covering reggae hits as far as we're concerned, but sometimes it turns out that they're not reggae hits, or they were reggae hits, but they were not original. They were covers, you know.
Right. And then you turn them into a reggae hit.
Yeah. Well, and the Chrissie one was, that was just, Chrissie gave us our first break in 1980. We went on tour with them. They had a number one album and a number one single at the time. Yeah. So we toured a sold out tour with them. And that kind of launched us, you know, on the bigger scene. We released a single while we were on the tour. When the tour finished, we were in the top five. So it really kind of launched us, you know. So we always talked about doing a record with Chrissie, because we got on great with her. We became friends, and she just kept saying, you know, we got to do a song together. And it took us years to get round to where we kind of met up again, you know. I mean, we kept seeing each other while we were on the road. We kept bumping into each other and saying, we must do a tune together, you know. And right. it kept going on. It was like, I think, 85, I think we, yeah, because it was on Bagga Redeem, so it would have been 85.
Yeah,
we finally got to do the track with her. And we claim that we thought of the song to cover it, and she claims that it was her idea.
Who knows?
It worked.
But it was a massive success. You know, it went number one for us in the UK, so it was brilliant. Yeah.
It worked
Chrissie
out.
Was doing great covers at the time. Right after that, she went off and did Walk Away with Cheap Trick and Robin Zander. And it's just like, wow, look at her doing all these great duets.
She could do great records with anybody. She's got a great voice, that girl.
She really does. So just quickly talk about this, because you're known as a reggae band, but I mean, these songs that you've covered end up on the pop charts, end up at the top of Billboard, at the top of the official UK chart. Do you see yourself as a pure reggae band, or are you somewhat of a pop band as well?
Well, I see reggae as pop music,
right?
As far as I'm concerned, you know, I'm not a Rastafarian. You know, I was listening to reggae before it became the Rasta music. You know, it was Jamaican pop music to me, and all the artists that I was listening to weren't Rastafarians. They were Jamaican music artists, you know, people like Ken Booth and Jimmy Cliff, etc. You know, they may have adopted the faith later on, but they, you know, it wasn't Rasta music, it was pop music. Yeah. And as I've already said, they were covering a lot of English and American pop music anyway. You know, Neil Diamond tunes and Beatles songs and all sorts, you know. So to me, it was just Jamaican pop music when it first, you know, from its inception in the sort of 67, I was a very young teenager, and that was all I listened to. But
how were you exposed to it?
Well, where we lived, it was a high immigrant area.
Yeah. Because I found this interesting. A lot of British artists, like, I mean, like, you know, one of the most famous reggae fans ever is Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols. Like, he's a huge reggae fan. And I always thought that was bizarre. Like, somebody that would be a punk guy would be influenced by reggae. And then, you know, like, how do you guys even discover it?
The whole punk movement was very much into reggae. It was very influenced by reggae and the reggae scene.
Yeah.
But we were listening to reggae long time before that. I was listening to Jamaican pop music before it was reggae, when it was ska, and in the 60s with people like Prince Buster. And then it slowed down and got much sexier and became reggae, you know. So where I was living, I was surrounded by all sorts of different immigrants, and therefore I heard all sorts of different musics. And the one that I heard most was the Jamaican music, and it's the one that I fell in love with. That's the one that all of my friends, the whole social circle, our gang, which became our band, we were all into reggae. That's what we loved, you know. I mean, some of the band were of Jamaican descent anyway. Their parents had come over from Jamaica in the 50s.
Yeah.
And others, I mean, we were all born in Birmingham, but we heard the music that was being played in Birmingham. And one of those musics, especially in the area that we grew up in, was reggae. So to us, it wasn't strange.
Black Sabbath in Birmingham?
Yes, of course, Black Sabbath. I mean, Birmingham is also, it's a complete cultural melting pot. It depends where you come from in Birmingham. Where we lived in Birmingham, you never heard heavy metal. You never heard heavy rock. What you heard was Indian Bhangra music and Jamaican reggae, you know. That was what we heard, as well as English pop music. Mm-hmm. You were hearing that as well. We're all hearing the Beatles, etc.
Well, that's and American music.
American pop
music.
We were loving Tamla Motown more than anything, you know. American music, of course, was very influential as well. But the music that we heard everywhere we went in the area that we lived was reggae, and that was the number one style. And when we formed a reggae band, we didn't discuss what kind of music or how to make it commercial. We just believed it was commercial, and you know, we just made it the way we wanted to make it. We were probably trying to be as close to an authentic Jamaican sounding reggae band as we could be, but it came out different because we're from Birmingham, England, you know.
Right. Home of Ozzy. So were you at all, I mean, you mentioned the Beatles real quick, but were you just not a fan of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and all those bands coming from that era, the, you know, the Zeppelins that were getting started? Would you just sort of go, meh, I'd rather listen to reggae? Or did that become part of you as well, and you just sort of used it differently?
Oh, yeah. We were certainly listening to the Beatles. I loved the Beatles as a kid. You know, I loved the whole British pop scene, you know, the whole Liverpool sound, the Mersey beat sound, all the harmony bands. I loved all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't love the Stones so much. I got to like them later on, but the Stones were a bit too sort of rocky for me, you know,
really?
A bit too bluesy. But because I was more into the pop side of it, I loved the Beatles, you know. But I loved all sorts of stuff. I loved the Everly Brothers, you know. I loved all sorts of things. Sam Cooke,
Yeah.
You know, Al Green, Otis Redding, you know, I loved all sorts of music and all
Paul
types
Anka?
Of music.
Paul Anka, because we're Canadian. Paul Anka, did you like Paul Anka?
a little bit of Celine Dion in there?
His way.
He did it. That'd be a great song for you to cover, quite frankly.
Yeah. Matt, what kind of music were you into growing up? Like, what were your influences?
You'll be 40. You sing?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. No, there's, you know, UB40 were just everywhere, you know, and they still are. And just everywhere you go in Birmingham, you just hear UB40. And they got under my skin and in my bones. And then, yeah. And then, you know, growing up, I got into other stuff as well, like heavy metal.
Like who?
You know, the kinds of pop music. Well, I was getting into kind of the bands at my time when I was getting into metal were bands like, I don't know if you've heard of Bullet for My Valentine, who were like,
yeah, of course.
We're
the heavy metal duo. We know all that stuff.
People like that. That was like, you know, when I was a teenager, but wow. I was kind of listening
later
to that
years.
As well as like Ken Booth and,
Matt Heffy.
Know, yeah, just, Alba Rossi and stuff like that. All different mishmash of everything, man. Like, music is kind of genreless in my eyes. I love everything.
Yeah. It'd be funny to see the singer of...
If you come from Birmingham, that's how it is, because there's so many different types. It's such a cultural melting pot, Birmingham. There's so many different types of music that if you're open to them, you can hear them all.
Right. Well, isn't that what makes a really great musician, just being into music?
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I agree with Matt. For me, there's two genres of music. Music I like and music that I don't like. I mean, that's really it. All this other stuff about, I mean, I got a press release the other day. It said math rock duo. And I went, math rock?
Math rock? Like, what does that even mean?
What the hell's math rock?
Yeah.
So, you know, Matt, talk to me quickly about taking over as a singer, because we know the story. We had a brother and another brother and another brother who didn't like the other brother. And then you turn up. Talk to me about filling those shoes, knowing the history, knowing that it's, you know, it's a bit of a effervescent history to say the least.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, so far it's just been, it's been just incredible. It's been everything that I always hoped that touring and being in a, you know, a big band would be like. And with the other stuff, you know, it's, for me, people sometimes ask, you know, like, does it get to you when people will say certain things or whatever about, you know, the original singer? And it's like, I really don't care. Like, to me, I'm singing for UB40, and that's all that matters. So any of the other stuff that kind of goes on, you know,
it's just whatever.
For me, this is just all incredible, and you know, I'm new to all this, and it's just, yeah, it's a dream come true.
Do you channel your inner Matt Heffy when you're singing? The listener of Trivium.
Sometimes, yeah. You don't really need to when you're singing reggae, like, you know, he. I wouldn't want to be I wouldn't want to be singing like him, singing Red Red Wine, but yeah, you know, sometimes all these different kind of front people, they all have an influence. Yeah, like Matt Heafy, who else? You know, even Amy Winehouse is a massive influence of mine. Something again, completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got to take all those influences, put them into that pot, mix it up, and see what comes out.
Mitch, we got to call Matt after we get off Zoom with them. We're going to tell him we just talked to the singer of UB40. He's a big fan, and we should get Trivium to do a cover of UB40's Red Red Wine with the singer.
Yeah, that would be great, actually. Matt's terrific.
Matt's the man.
Down for that.
Let's quickly talk about the continued success of the band and making new music, because a lot of bands, especially that have been around for 20 or 30 years, they get out there, they do the show, they play their 10 hits, their 12 hits, their 15 hits, they go merci, bonsoir, and they go home. You're still making new music. Why is that important, and other than just being, you know, a creative outlet?
Well, that's it, really. It is our creative outlet. It's what we do. It's what we've been doing for, well, we'll be celebrating 45 years next year, you know. we don't want to be a cabaret act.
Right.
We don't want to just go out and play the old hits, you know. I mean, we've had a lot of them over the years. I think that in the UK we've had nearly 50 top 40 hits, you know. So yeah, we could just actually. We could, sorry?
I think you've had 50 top hits.
Yeah, something like that. But, you know, we could just do that. We could just do a two-hour set of old hits, you know. But we like being current. We like working together. We still like working in the studio. We like making new music. And there's nothing better than to get out on the road and play to your audience your new music, you know, and get their reaction, get their seal of approval. We love being a live band. We love playing them our new stuff, and we love getting a reaction off them. You know, that's what it's all about for us. We play the old stuff more or less because we have to, because it's expected. You know, and you want to create a party vibe, so of course you want to play the songs they know and love and want to dance along and sing to. So songs like Red Red Wine always get done. You know, we always play those tunes. We always play Kingston Town. We always play Can't Help Falling in Love. And then, you know, we always play some new stuff too. That's what it's about. And we love doing that. And I don't think it'll ever, I can't imagine that we're ever going to stop working on new stuff. You know, we may not be as prolific as we used to be, but, you know, we still enjoy working. And now, when you get injections of new talent like this young man here, it's you know, then it gets the juices flowing again. Yeah, you know?
Re-energizes you.
Exactly. Absolutely. Really, he has re-energized us, just as getting my other younger brother Duncan in energized us 14 years ago when he came in with us. It reinvigorated the band, you know. And the same has happened since he retired, and Matt's coming. The same has happened. We're all firing on all cylinders and raring to go. We've just, myself and Matt just wrote a song that we recorded, and we're really pleased with it. We're really happy, and we're looking forward to getting the time to work on some more stuff together, you know.
Yeah, totally.
You have one? Because I had one more.
Oh, go ahead, Mitch.
Well, I was going to ask you the importance of the MTV era and Much Music and videos, because growing up in Montreal, I did not hear UB40 on the radio. If you're thinking, you know, 81, 82, 83, whatever. And then the Much Music comes to town and you're on there all the time. And so for me, I discovered you through the visual and through video and through the video medium. How important was that for your career? Did it lead to a big breakthrough? Was it sort of just an addition, or was it really a game changer?
I think it was different in different areas, you know, okay. Different territories. I think places where we hadn't broken big when the video thing happened and we released the Labour of Love album with the Labour of Love video. I mean, that video was like 40 minutes long and contained all the pop videos within a story, you know. And that got played on everything, like MTV, etc. You know, it was so it made a big difference to us, but we weren't really aware of it, because it was, to us, we were still playing records, you know, and it was a kind of minor inconvenience that you had to shoot a video as well to go, you know, with your record. I always felt like it was a strange thing to do, to be making a film to help to sell a piece of music, you know. It always seemed a strange thing to do, but it became the norm because of MTV, I guess. And in the end, it helped us, you know, and it was something that we always did. Again, it's now kind of, it doesn't have the importance that it used to have, you know, just as records don't. You know, the most important thing now is to be out on the road and playing, you know, which of course COVID killed that for the last couple of years. But, you know, we'll be, hopefully we're free again, and we should be able to get around the world again.
Right. And I mean, the song Red, Red Wine, I mean, I play it like every other day still on my radio show here in Montreal and in Toronto. And it's also kind of like gotten a new lease on life too with social media, like being in memes on TikToks and different things. Like, yeah, it's kind of cool to see the song just like transcend generations and like the new generations turning it into something else for themselves.
Yeah, it'll probably end up on an advert next.
Sell it. Put it in like a Geico commercial or something.
Something like that, yeah.
You know? UB40's Big Up Bigger Rhythm Tour with the original Wailers featuring Al Anderson, Maxi Priest. Big Mountain tour dates include River Breeze, Event Center, Knoxville, Tennessee. Kick it off on August 18th. Running all the way through into September. Honestly, it's going to be a big tour. What's it going to be like being on the road with the original Wailers? That's pretty cool. Talking about like a power reggae bill, man.
Yeah, it's not the first time. We've played with the Wailers before.
Yeah,
they've opened in the UK for us and various other places around the world. So it's not new, but it's a slightly different Wailers every time you play with them. You know, the last time we played with the Wailers, it was Family Man Aston Family Man Barrett, the bass player, but he's retired now. So now I think the only original guy out of the that's in the Wailers, even though they call themselves the original Wailers, I think the only one is Al Anderson, the guitarist. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that should be fun. I like the bill all the way around. I mean, you know, we love Maxi Priest. He's a star in his own right, and we've worked with him as well. You know, we've recorded with Maxi, and he's open for us several places around the world, Australia and New Zealand, and you know, so we know Maxi well. We like Maxi. He's a good guy. So and Big Mountain. I'm looking forward to seeing Big Mountain and seeing if they've got any song other than the one that I know, which is, you know, Baby, I Love Your Way.
Right. You don't go out and listen to like their Spotify top five before you pick your opening act. Like, oh, they, do I know their song?
I think I ought to. But the thing was, we didn't pick this lineup. It was actually a lineup that was suggested to us for playing the US tour. And we liked the lineup. You know, it seems to me like a lineup that will appeal to an American audience.
Wow, and it looks good on a marquee. I mean,
Yeah.
But of course, Canadian audiences here. We're waiting. We're waiting for you. Is there a Canadian tour coming?
Hopefully, you have to have a Canadian promoter that wants to do it. You know, it's not like you just click your fingers and it happens. You know, you have to get. You have to find promoters that want to do these things.
Robin, Mitch is lying to you. He doesn't go to concerts anymore.
There's so many people out on the road at the moment that it's hard to get the slots, you know. Hard to get dates. It's ridiculous. We just did some dates in Europe and we were zigzagging all over the place because the dates had to, you know, the availability of venues was just ridiculous. The same in the UK as well. We were up north and then we were down south and then we were up north again. It was crazy just because of availability for dates, you know.
Yeah. Up and down the coast, yeah.
Last question for Matt. Matt, UB40 is not going to go on for the next 30 years, I don't think. What sort of your plan?
I'm not so sure about that.
Well, let's hope.
We'll know.
Well, it could, yeah. I guess. I guess we could brand it out. Serious question, though. Could we brand it out and just keep the name going and just sort of switch out the players? I mean, Foreigner has done it. I Village think, People has done it.
The original Wailers are doing it.
Yeah.
And there's nothing. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with that.
There's many bands doing it.
People want to hear the songs.
If you've got a sound, you know, and if you can bring people in that are younger, and they play with you and thereby learn to play the original sound and sound like you, then why not? I mean, the Drifters have been going for how long? 60 years, you know?
Right.
And I don't think there certainly aren't any originals, you know, but they still sound like the Drifters. And I don't see any reason why there couldn't be a UB40 playing in 20 years' time, you know? And I can't imagine any of us.
There'll always be an audience.
I don't know if any of the originals will be left in 20 years' time, but, you know, If I'm not gone, if I haven't dropped, I'll still be there. I'll still be playing.
Yeah.
And at least it'll be
I'm sure we can recruit other people and just keep it going, you know? Why not?
And brand Trump's band every time. Every
time. Yeah, absolutely. Look, best of luck with the tour. We're going to catch up with you guys next time. Welcome back to the show anytime. Hopefully we'll get some Canadian dates and stuff. I'd love to go see one of the shows in New York or Boston or something.
I'd love to come to Canada, man. It would be brilliant.
When's the last time you guys toured Canada?
Cool, dear. We did do it with Duncan, but probably 10 years ago now.
Wow. So yeah, you guys need to get back here. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, love it.
And it's funny. I was actually talking to a promoter today, but about a different thing. So maybe I'll have to get him to do.
Give him a call.
Yeah, absolutely. Robin, just real quick before you go, were you like through the years as a guitar player? Are you a crazy guitar gear nut? Like, have you recorded? Have you like collected all kinds of gear over the years and stuff? You got 100 guitars or?
Nah. I do. I kept the original guitar that I bought. My first electric guitar was a left-handed Fender Strat. It was a 1954 Fender Strat, and I've still got it. And it's, you know, it's still my original guitar. But I've never been a collector like that, really. I'm not even that much into guitar playing. I just do what needs to be done, you know. I don't practice. I don't do anything. I just play chords, you know, and occasionally pick something out, but I'm not a hardline.
You're not a gear slut
at all.
No,
not really. I'm much more into vocals and production than I am playing guitar. Guitar is just a kind of necessity, you know, for me to work out the chord sequence and stuff.
Yeah. You're more worried about, am I using an SM58 on stage or is it a Sennheiser 935? Or what are we using here?
Yeah, much more about the mic I use.
I like that, though. All right. Well, look, let's wrap up here. Go check out UB40 on tour this summer. Tickets are available now wherever you get your music. Pick up their latest record as well. I mean, this band's just phenomenal live, and you're just going to have so much fun. Mitch, just one more time. What's the tour called?
Well, it is the Bigger Ragadim tour. Close enough.
Good Lord.
Listen, it's the UB40 tour. That's all you need.
Bigger Ragadim. Bigger Ragadim.
Bigger Ragadim tour.
You got to say it 20 times before you go to bed tonight.
I'm going to have that stuck in my head for the rest of the day now.
Yeah, well, just the title sounds like a song. It's got a rhythm to it, which is kind of cool. So,
yeah.
Now back to the Mitch LaFon and Jeremy White Show.
We are speaking with the one and only Greg Hart, of course, of the band Cats in Space. A new album, Kick Start the Sun, is out. Well, it's out now. And as we say here in Montreal, bonjour, comment allez-vous?
Oh, bonjour and other words.
And other words, right.
Bonjour, Mitch.
Bonjour. So, listen, I love Cats in Space. Yeah, the band came out a few years ago. I mean, what are we looking at now? 5 years? 2017?
2015.
Yeah, okay, so 7 years we're looking at.
Yeah, we're getting on a bit now.
Yeah, and you've changed singers over that time. We know that. And you know, the band has had members changes. But talk to me about putting this band together, because you've been out there. You've written with Asia. You've done some other stuff. You've been on the scene for years. Talk to me about this band and making it viable and making it a band, because it is. It's a different marketplace. It's a tough marketplace.
It is. It's madness. I mean, as we said many times, that the band was put together back in 2015 by myself and Mick Wilson, just purely as a songwriting kind of project, if you like. You know, Mick was in 10cc. I wanted to write a bunch of songs. It was like the 70s. Stevie Bacon, the drummer, came involved. We kind of put a little business plan together, got some players in. Jeff Brown, who was in the suite for many years, came on board. Dean Howard from Tapao and Ian Gillan came on board. And we
By the
had,
way, Tapao. I haven't heard Tapao, that name man. In years. That's a band Tapao. Right there. All right.
Dean's your Tapao. He was the rock man in Tapao, yeah. And Andy Stewart on keyboards, who has been alongside me for many years. And we kind of... Before we knew what we was doing, we had this band and this album that everybody loved. In this kind of quirky 70s style that someone said, oh, it's never going to work, you're mad. And we found out there's an awful lot of people out there that like going back in time and reminiscing about the great days of 70s rock music. And we went out and did a few gigs. It grew from there. We ended up touring with Status Quo, Deep Purple, Thunder, who I know you're a big fan of.
Thunder, that's right. The greatest rock band ever.
Yeah, Hyde Park with Phil Collins and Blondie. We did the London Palladium with Bonnie Tyler. You know, it just grew. And what was basically a vanity project grew into a business, a cottage industry that we run ourselves. Yeah. And we're on Kickstart the Sun is now our fifth album. And we've got Damien Edwards singing with us now. He joined us for the Atlantis album, which was album 4. Yeah.
And he did the greatest hits, the Diamond.
Yeah, he did the Diamond thing. Yeah, he did that too. He did the Atlantis album, but we also did a lot of songs for Diamonds, which was intentional for kind of the German market. It's like a promo thing to announce the new singer and to try and get some dates over in Germany. And of course, COVID knocked all that out of the water. So we just released it as a compilation album, as a stopgap between Atlantis and now what will be Kickstart the Sun. Damien did War of the Worlds with Jeff Wayne. So the band's got a hell of a good pedigree. They're amazing players. They're amazing people. They're just the best bunch of people that you could ever wish to work with. And they share the dream, and we're all mental, and we just go out and we want to relive the 70s and take it to the world. It seems to be a lot of people out there that need to have some good time 70s vibes going on right now, you know? Yep.
Now, I do want to talk about the 70s sound, but first, you did mention that you turned it into a business. And to me, it turned into a business a lot based on the name and the visuals. You look at the T-shirts, you look at the album covers, you look at all that merchandise. It's fun, and it's quirky, and it's interesting. You go, there's a cat in a UFO, and it's got colors, and it's bright. Anyway, just talk to me about the importance of that, because, you know, had you just thrown, no offense, like, your faces on the album, people would have went, you got some old guys on an album. But you look at, no offense, but you look at the album covers, and you go, oh, this is fun. Look at these colors. It's bright, it's red, it's cats, it's...
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I mean, we all come, I mean, myself and Stevie in particular, we've got an art background. I mean, I've been an artist for years, painting and stuff. Stevie is an incredible digital artist that does stuff. No, I don't even know what that side is, but he's amazing at it. And of course, we knew a guy called Andy Kitson, who is a fantastic Formula One motorsport artist who's really well known in the UK, is doing these incredible paintings of Formula One. And he's also a massive 70s rock fan. And he kind of came on board and started designing stuff. And we designed the cat helmet. And right from day one, I said, look, we're kind of knocking on a bit here. I don't know whether we'll sell many T-shirts of our ugly mugs on it.
We can joke about that without being insulting. It's true.
It doesn't matter. Yeah,
nobody wants to see my face. That's why I do a podcast.
Yeah, well, I call it the ELO syndrome. Back in the 70s, ELO shifted millions of albums based on that spaceship with the ELO logo.
Yes.
They didn't know who was in the band apart from maybe Jeff Lynne. So sometimes it isn't about it's not like the 80s when it was the hair metal and everybody had to sell themselves on being a pretty boy. We've done all that.
Right.
But we thought if we come up with a really cool logo, that logo will sell the band better than we ever could.
Yes.
To the point now that we can put a cat pod on a picture and no name of the band, and a lot of people go, oh, that's Cats in Space.
Yes.
So it's like Iron Maiden's Eddie. And at the end of the day, merchandise is king in this game nowadays. You've got to have your merch right. You've got to have your branding right. You've got to not be fussy with it. You know, you can't keep changing your logo every 5 minutes.
No.
You know, Kiss, 4 letters, Kiss, done. Thank you very much. Biggest marketing band in history. And I basically took everything from the Gene Simmons handbook of making money for merch. And, you know, it's doing this well, you know, because, like you said, it's fun, it's colourful, and it's bloody good. You know, it's really...
Yes.
Our artworks are fantastic, if I do say so myself. And I
fully agree, and that's not even being unmodest or immodest. It's being honest. Mm. It truly is. And and the good thing about your artwork and your logo is Kickstart the Sun could be the final album you make, but your T-shirts could sell for another decade with no new music coming out, because people are going to say, I like that logo. And that's a win. that's
a win-win. We said from day one, it's win-win if you get your logo right. It will always be a brand. I mean, even as a company called EMP in Europe, we're a huge clothing and heavy rock kind of franchise thing, and they sell clothing and all sorts of things, but they also sell vinyl, and they've actually now taken the new album, which is amazing because they only take kind of Kiss and Slipknot and Metallica and stuff like that. Right. Yet they've taken our new album on under their brand as well, and HMV Music are taking on an exclusive vinyl for the new album. I think they're starting to realize is that it looks good, you know, and I think we'll continue to sell, you know, our artworks and our products. Like you said, after the music stops, we'd always be able to do stuff with make a cartoon series out of it. In fact, someone the other day said, would you ever do a cartoon series based on Cats in Space? I went, absolutely, 100%.
Yes.
You know, Hanna-Barbera, HR Puffin stuff. You know, it's all stuff that we're close to, as crazy and childlike as it is. We love all that stuff, you know, and it's good. It's eternal.
Yeah, and now before fans get the impression that you're just a brand and it's just, you know, a nice logo, you back it up on top of that with great music. So let's talk about the music and let's sell the music a little bit. Talk to me a little bit about the new album, Kickstart the Sun, because I was listening to it and I've been listening to it for the last couple of weeks. And at moments I'm thinking, oh, I'm listening to David Bowie. And then at other times I'm going, oh, I'm listening to The Sweet. And then at other times I'm thinking, oh, that sounds like Queen. And yet, it's not Queen, it's not David Bowie, it's not it's Cats in Space with these with a little bit of cinnamon and cardamom and a little, you know, it's all blended in, but it's still your sound. Talk to me about sort of tipping the hat without becoming a cover band and tipping the hat and just saying, hey man, those were great tunes and we're going to give you fresh music, but with a little bit of, I see the Thin Lizzy Jailbreak back there on your wall.
Signed by Phil Lynott.
Nice. I mean, we'll have to see.
That was signed in 1976 on the Johnny the Fox tour.
Wow. Were you a musician at the time, or just a fan that met him backstage kind of thing?
No, I was going to see gigs back then, and a friend of mine got those signatures, and they gave them to me as a birthday present years later.
I saw
Lizzie in 78. I think I saw Brian Robinson's last ever gig with him, actually. So,
Was Huey Lewis on stage singing with a harmonica when you saw him?
No, that was the tour before. We saw them with Horselips. That was great. But yeah, to be honest, I mean, I come from the 70s. I was brought up on 70s music by two older brothers. I've always loved 70s pop. You know, I love the Carpenters. I love Donna Summer. I love the quirky songs that came out in the 70s. I love the rock stuff, So I soaked up an awful lot of influence as a kid. David Bowie especially, that was the first album, grown-up album that I ever got, was Aladdin Insane when I was nine, I think it was. And so Cats in Space was the first band that really was the vehicle for me to really just write songs purely for my own love of the 70s music. And, you know, there's a little nod to 10cc there. There's a nod to Queen with the Brian May guitars and the harmonies. I thought, why shouldn't we? Because, again, don't forget, this was a project to start with. It was purely for my own vanity. I'm going to do 10 songs that are going to kind of really heavily be influenced by all the music that I grew up loving. And if people don't like it, fair enough, but I've done it. But they were coming on board saying, oh, my God, you sound like ELO. You sound like Supertramp. How do you do it? I said, we're just brave enough to not shy away from using the sounds that they used to use. And don't forget, we do a lot of stuff analog, and it's all old school, and we use real instruments and vintage equipment, and we've always maintained that across the albums. And I think as time's gone on, and obviously we're writing for the next album, there's more confidence in the fact that we can do this and people really want us to do it, rather than they're just taking the mickey out of this, or, you know, it would have fallen on its backside on the first album if it wasn't going to work. And it didn't. People just went, oh my God. Even Francis Rossi from Quo, when we toured with them, he came out on the first night and thought, oh no, they're going to be like Iron Maiden with their long hair. And he said, I heard these beautiful harmonies coming off the stage, and we all had to stop what we was doing and go, who's this band that are supporting us? And they quickly downloaded our album, and they became big fans of the band. I said, why? I said, no one does melodies like that anymore.
Right.
I said, well, it's a pity that the business has got to the point where you're shocked to hear melody. You know, so I'll take a melody from the Carpenters or you know, MacArthur Park or John Miles or whoever, and I incorporate into the Cat sound. And we just found this magic formula that isn't reinventing the wheel, but we've kind of made our own thing out of it, which is astonishing, really, when you yes. think about where we come from.
Yes, and I say that respectfully. You nod to those bands, but you're not a cover band. You are Cats in Space doing Cats yeah. in Space music.
Yeah.
But if you listen to it and you love that music like I do, you go, "Ooh, I feel comfortable here. I feel comfortable listening to this." So then talk to me then about the recording process, because, you know, we've gotten to that time of everything is Pro Tools and we have all our beats and rhythms and all that just in the computer and you just hit a button you're not doing that.
Nope. We obviously have to use Pro Tools for the mixing process and, you know, you have to eventually go into hard drive, obviously, but we use old fashioned proper recording studios with old fashioned equipment. We go through a proper old fashioned desk. We make sure everything's got the old 70s crunch to it as it's going on. But instead of going to tape, it just goes onto the hard drive, if you like. But we make sure that every part of the process before that is as real as possible. We did some recording at Rack Studios in London for this album.
Yeah, Thunder's recorded there.
The desk we used was the desk that did all that Hot Chocolate, Susie Quattro, Smokey, all those Mud, all those songs in the 70s. We're on that desk and we're staying in Mickey Most's apartment. And it was like being back in 1977. And when you soak that up over a period of a week or two, you play different, you vibe different, you approach things different, and you just go into your little time capsule. And as you said, Cats in Space is all about taking people back to that comfy time when we were kids and all we had to look forward to was the next Rush album and can't wait to see the album cover and the gatefold and the lyrics and soaking it all up. And we kind of, that's where we live. So the recording process is done exactly the same way. We make sure everything, we transport ourselves back in time when we do it. And we do spend a lot of time on it. I mean, Kickstart took 8 months to record. You know, one track alone took 10 days to mix. 10 days to record and 7 days to mix, because we are putting so much information and it's so cinematic what we're doing now that it's huge stuff that you can't just knock out on a computer using drum loops and a few keyboard sounds. You know, we're using banks of guitars. You know, I can't even start to count up the amount of guitars we use in the recording process. 30, 40 different guitars maybe, because we can. You know, we love doing it. It's like the old days. It's like when Rush went to record A Farewell to Kings at Rockfield, and you imagine what it was like there in those days. I want to do that. I want to have all the guitars out and the massive drum kit and the tubular bells and the kettle drums all laid out, and we can just go up to one of the things and say, right, let's use this now. And it makes for a much better music, I think, to be fair.
It really does. Let's talk a little bit about the packaging, since you know you're talking about how you had those Rush albums with the gatefold. When you get a Cats in Space product, it is not just a cheap one sheet insert. It is glossy. It is colorful. It is full of information. It talks about, you know, who did what. It's very old school. Talk to me about also providing a proper package, because when you plunk down that $20 to buy Kickstart the Sun or Too Many Gods or Scarecrow or whatever, you're not just getting 10 songs on a cheap CD. You're getting a keepsake.
Yeah, you want bang for buck. I mean, again, it's like there is so much music out in the world today. And also bearing in mind that when you're 50 odd, you've built up this huge wall of albums and CDs throughout your life. Yep. You've got to make sure that what you do is valid enough for them to want to put it into their their treasured collection. And there's so much option for people to buy stuff nowadays. You've got to make your stuff stand out and be as good quality. People expect it. They want, you know, they don't want to see, you know, cheap albums on CDs.
But you see them all the time. That's the problem.
Exactly. So we make sure, and also this comes a lot from, again, the artistic background, that we as we're recording an album, we normally have the album title before we even do the album. Right. And then we think this album's going to be this journey, so let's write songs for that journey. It's going to have this piece of artwork, gatefold, we've got a lyric booklet, we've got different variants of vinyl, there's, you know, there's a deluxe CD with extra tracks on it. I think if you can offer that to people now, they see that you're the real deal. And I think punters are very quick at sussing out fakes and people adjusting it for the wrong reasons. And they see us and they know we're the real deal. We're not mucking about. No. And, you know, we are at the twilight end of our career, if you like, you know. So everything we do, we really want it to be the best it can be, because it's got to stay in people's collections for forever.
Yes. You
know, they got their Queen albums. I want Cats in Space albums to be treasured like their Queen albums. And God bless our fans. The comments we get are totally overwhelming at times when they say Night of the Opera was my all-time favorite record and Atlantis has just beaten it. And I went, you can't be serious about that. And this guy was, I'm deadly serious. He came and saw us on tour last year and he said, I never thought Night of the Opera. I mean, you can't take words like that in, you know, when someone reckons your album is better than Night of the Opera. I mean, we are not worthy, you know. But it proves that if you hit the right target with some of these people, they will take you exceptionally seriously.
Yes, and the 70s fan, that older fan, is very loyal. If you give them something they like, they will stick with you. You know, they just will. You had a chance to write with Bob Mitchell, who wrote famously "The Flame" for Cheap Trick.
Yeah,
one of the greatest, I guess, power ballads. I guess is the term for it, a ballad. One of the greatest rock ballads, I guess. Talk to me about your association with Bob Mitchell and how did you get to meet him and what was the situation and did any of the songs that you wrote with him get anywhere, go somewhere?
That's a great question, Mitch. That's good, that. I'm glad you asked that because there's a really good story here, which I'll try and be quick about. When I was signed to a publishing company many, many years ago when I was in London, my publisher, a guy called Pete McCamley, who's absolute legend, he said, you need to write with some big name writers to really hone your skill because you obviously, you've got a lot to offer here, but you need more experience.
Right.
And I was like 25, 26 at the time or something. So he said, I got to work with quite a lot of people, actually, a guy called Bob Marlette, who wrote with Neil Schon and stuff like that. And that went very well. And he said, you know a guy called Bob Mitchell? I went, no, I don't. He said, but he's just written a song for Cheap Trick called The Flame. I went, you are kidding me. He said, do you know it? I went, do I know it? I said, it's number one in America, isn't it? He went, yeah. He lives down in Surrey. I went, no way. So I met Bob and he came into the studio to write a song for my band, If Only. And we wrote a song called The Ghost of You. Superb, you know, he was just so vibey and we just got on so well. So we smashed that one, then we wrote a song called Tumbling Dice, and then we wrote another song which was called I Remember. And he phoned me up one night from America and he said, great, he said, Bob here, how attached are you to Tumbling Dice? I went, well, it's one of the key songs that we're trying to tout around to get a record deal because we had no record deal at the time.
Right.
And then I've got someone that's interested in it. I said, who? He said, Patti Smith. I went, Patti Smith, what? The Smythe, as in the girl from Scandal. And he went, yeah, that's the one. He said, they want to record it as potentially a single on her new album. And I couldn't let it go because it was a key track on us getting an album deal. So next thing I know, she's gone at number one with Don Henley. So I was absolutely gutted. So but after that, he then got in touch again. He said, hi, Greg, I'm at a party in somewhere, Beverly Hills or something. He said, I'm at Donna Summer's party. I'm with her mum who manages Donna's art collection or something. I can't remember, something like that. He said, I think I've got us a song away. That song I remember, she's going to cut it. Really? So I said, yeah, please do, because it's not going to be an If Only song. So they sent a contract through on my birthday. We signed it and the song went off to Donna Summer and she cut it. Then halfway through the process, as far as I know and I was told, the producer got fired and he brought a new guy in and he said, why are you doing all this rock stuff? Like, sure, leave it alone. You need to do the disco album. And they canned off my song off of the half of the album that was going to be it, but she was going to do a rock album. So somewhere there's a version of Donna Summer singing one of my songs. Wow. Which was amazing, but it's never seen the light of day. So, and then grunge came out and the band split up and I our paths kind of drifted apart of it. And Bob went into some theatre stuff and that was it. But the funny thing was, I was in Vegas about 4 months ago, and I went to see Cheap Trick at the Strat. Unbelievable gig. One of the best gigs I've ever seen. The set list was phenomenal. And when they played The Flame, wow. It was just like, oh, my mate wrote this. You know, the couple next to me were from Canada, and I went, my mate wrote this. You know, it's like one of those things. So, yeah, Bob was such a cool dude. I'd love to see him again because he was a great man. He really was, you know.
Let me just ask you, Cheap Trick or Rick Nielsen has said that he hates the song and blah, blah, blah. The record company forced it. And yet they play it. Right. But yet they take the money and they still play it, which is fine. But did Bob ever talk to you about that and say, oh, that son of a gun, why is he dissing my song?
But the funny thing, he told me how the song went to number one because they were on tour with Motley Crue at the time.
Right.
And he said, I got a phone call late one night from his partner who co-wrote it, Nick Graham, I think it is.
Yeah.
He said, Bob, he said, The Flame's just gone in the charts at number 85 or something. He went, oh, wow, cool. He said, Cheap Trick had just started a tour with Motley Crue. He said, it's going down well. They're starting to pick it up on the stations. And he said, it went up the chart week in, week out as they're on this tour. He goes, Bob, it's number 14. Bob, it's number 30 with a bullet. Bob, it's number 20. Bob, it's going to go top 10. And they went, he said, it could go higher. And he said, it went into the 10. And then he said, Bob, we've been told it might be number one. And he just said, he bought the house next door. He's buying cars out the front and all this kind of stuff. And I went, oh, what was that like, man? And he said, you know what, Greg, where you're sitting right now at my dining table, he said, I wrote it here. And I was singing the melody and the words to Nick down the phone in America, and that's how we finished the song off. And he played me the little tape, like dictaphone tape message of him scatting the original version of The Flame. I'm like, what? And he looked at me and he went, don't worry, mate, you'll have one of these.
That's
so cool. And then he said the phone after then didn't stop ringing. He said every record company said, can those guys write us another Flame for House of Lords, did a song called Remember My Name.
Yep.
That was a Bob Mitchell song. That was like Flame Part 2. Then another one wanted The Flame. They wanted one for Winger, one for Warren. You know, all those bands are all the time. It's like, you can't keep rewriting The Flame. But that's when the power ballads, I think they pioneered the AOR power ballad being the big go-to song for those rock bands, you know, so...
Well, listen, I was a Cheap Trick fan, and when Lap of Luxury came out, they were almost a forgotten band. People were like, meh, from this. And then The Flame hit, and people went, oh, Cheap Trick is back. So, it changed everything. And by the way, it's funny that you mentioned that they were looking for other singles, because I used to speak to Doug Feger of The Knack. And I would, and we talked about My Sharona quite a bit. And he said to me one time, he said, you know, it's that golden albatross. He goes, it's golden because the pool, the cars, it all bought that. But it's an albatross because every time I went to the record company with new music, they'd say, well, that's really good, but can you write us another My Sharona? And it drove him nuts.
I bet.
You know, so I can imagine coming to Bob all the time going, so can you write us another The Flame? At some point, you just go,
no.
He's going, no, fuck. I'll write you a new Hink to Hit single, you know?
Exactly. That's why I got so much respect for bands like Queen and Bowie and stuff that kept reinventing them rather than rewriting Bo Rap time and time again. They went, no, we're done with that. Let's move on. I mean, I always look at the Queen stuff. It's amazing how brave they were to change from Bo Rap to Crazy Little Thing Called Love in 4 years.
Yeah. And you know, not a lot of bands can do that. Madonna can do that. U2 can do that. They can change. And then there are some bands like AC/DC where the fans go, that's AC/DC. Don't start with loops and effects.
That's not going to work.
And it's amazing that there are bands like I said, or artists like Madonna, who can just, you're expected to change, and other bands are like, just give me Kiss. No, I don't want, no, just give me Kiss.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think if you establish yourself early doors that you're going to be like that, I guess people get on the ride or they don't. But yeah, like when you do 4 or 5 albums at the same, you're kind of stuck in a rut then. But you know, power to any band that can do more than 4 or 5 albums in a career anyway. It's blooming hard, you know. I mean, we're on album five, and I never thought we'd get to album five. And all, if I was really honest, we joked that we'll do nine albums, and the ninth one will be called Nine Lives, and that'll be it. But careful what you wish for, because it's getting close now.
But okay, the 10th album will be one final life, you know, one extra life, bonus life.
Yeah.
You know, bonus life. Anyway, Kickstart the Sun, available now. You can get that. Hold on, I don't have your website up here.
It's out on the 29th of July. Is the official release date?
Oh, correct. Yes. And we are only the 22nd. See, look at that. I'm having a whole hard time with times today.
It's a bad day for you, Mitch.
Oh, time-wise. But catsinspace.co.uk. You can head over and pre-order that now. I've had a chance to listen to it because I had a little preview, and it is terrific. And when you're over at the Cats in Space, go over to the merch side and just pick up a cool tea and a cool whatever else, because there's just a lot of stuff. I'm looking at it right now and now I'm mesmerized and I can't even talk to you because I'm just I'm looking at all the cat swag. Look at all this stuff.
Oh, no, be careful.
I know. It just sucks you in. It's delightful. Oh, look at those mugs. I'm gonna have to go get a mug later.
Oh, no, and we got the Kickstart stuff to come out as well. We got the tour t-shirts coming out when the tour starts at the end of September. There'll be Christmas stuff coming out. We do calendars, we've started doing music books as well. We're starting to do the albums in chronological order as music books, because we keep getting asked, when will you do the sheet music so I can learn how to play the songs? You know, it's amazing, really. I never thought all this was going to happen. And it's a lot of work because we are a cottage industry doing it all ourselves, but it's so rewarding when you can sit back and watch the look on people's faces and they just love it, you know?
Hey, listen, and if it's good enough for Paul Carrick to do it solo like this, man, it's good enough for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And the new album will blow people away, I guarantee you it.
I agree. It blew me away. There you go. Merci bien, as we say in Montreal. Thank you.
Superb. Thank you very much, Mitch.
Always a pleasure. And we will do this for album 7, 8, 9, and the 10th one.
And the 10 bonus. Yeah.
Cheers.
God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. All right. Perfect. Bye now. That was great. Thank you. Sorry for all the delays. My time calendar is complete.
Take the rest of the day off, mate. Take the rest of the day off.
Yes, sir. Cheers.
Is it the day? I don't know. Is it night or day? I can't remember now. Where are you? What time is it?
I'm in Montreal. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon right now.
Oh, okay. It's not too bad then. Not too bad. Oh. But yeah, no, thanks for that, Mitch. That was superb. And yeah, see you out there, hopefully, one day.
Yes. And I actually thought tomorrow was the 29th. So tomorrow's the
27th. I don't know.
Back to the doctor. Thank you, sir. Yeah. Cheers.
An all-new episode of the Mitch LaFon and Jeremy White Show.
Tuesday at noon.
Available wherever you stream.
Catch up on past interviews,
bonus content,
and episodes on demand now.
Visit youtube.com/Jeremy White Show. Follow Mitch and Jeremy on Twitter. Yeah, they're verified. @MitchLaFon and @JeremyWhiteMTL.